Welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we are embracing the journey. Embrace the journey. Are you doing that? If you had even a moment's hesitation, you have to listen to my conversation with Deborah Heiser today. Many of you are probably mentoring someone in your life, never realizing the value you're passing along. Deborah spells it all out for us. We have value, perhaps more value than we realize. And just as likely as is our role as mentor, perhaps we are also being mentored. That value can go in several directions. I will admit, Deborah's repeated compliments of the value of this podcast that I offer, were so very nice. You'll get to the end of this conversation today either motivated to add more value to the world or content that you are adding more value than you ever realized. Listen now. Too many people I know feel they've not really done anything important or exciting in their life, whether personal or professional. So the idea of mentorship rarely crosses their mind. But how about this from my guest's website? Embark on a transformative journey where age is merely a gateway to endless possibilities. Welcome to a world where wisdom meets innovation and every chapter brings new discoveries. For the last few weeks, I've been easing into the new identity for this podcast. Boomer Women, Embrace the Journey. With the tagline, that was then, this is now, design your own next chapter. Sound like we're a match? I sure thought so. My guest today is an applied developmental psychologist, author of The Mentorship Edge, and founder of The Mentor Project. So I think she'll have some great thoughts for us. Deborah Heiser, welcome to the Boomer... I've got to do this right now. See, I'm so used to saying welcome to the Boomer Woman's podcast. Welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we embrace the journey.
Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation. How did you get into the field of older adults and mentoring?
Well, it was, it's a long route and it's a two-part route. The first part is I didn't even know what a psychologist was. I didn't know of a field of aging. I went to visit my grandmother in Florida and I was, 19 or 20. And she was usually the most fun person anyone could ever meet. I never had to take clothes down there because she was the most fashionable person and I would just wear her clothes. And I went down on one occasion and she was not herself. She was grouchy and she was not put together. And so I said to the person that worked down there, there's something wrong with grandma. And the person said, oh, don't worry, we're going to fix her. And I was like, what? So they said, she's depressed. She's taking a new medication for her COPD, and it's causing her to be depressed. So by the time you come back in a couple of months, she's going to be fine. I didn't believe them, but I came back a couple of months later, and she was fine. She was back to herself, and she had a boyfriend named Wilbur. So I said, that's it. I am going to become a grandma fixer. So that's how I went into the field of aging and psychology. Was I was completely smitten now. I thought, wow, this is something I have to do. And then once I got started with studying everything no one wants to have or get, which is what I did, I became a researcher. And I was really excited by it. But I went to a conference and somebody said, what do we have to look forward to as we age? And I was stumped. I was like putting Band-Aids on everything nobody wants to have. And so I had to think for myself, what do I want to look forward to? And so I went back to the drawing board, went back to theory and research about, you know, our development and our whole trajectory for life. And I couldn't believe how much was there, but nobody was talking about it. And so this got me really thinking about particularly a midlife stage where we are built to want to give back to others, just the same as we're built to walk and talk. And that's what got me into mentoring, because mentoring is one form of giving back that we really like to embark on in midlife and older, that brings us satisfaction and allows us to sort of show what we know and what we've built up in ourselves over decades.
Okay. And I'm just going to pull some of the talking points off of your profile. Why is membership? Boy, I'm tongue-tied today. I really apologize. Why is mentorship so powerful for us?
Well, you know, we have a desire to give back, right? Because we want to feel like we matter. Our footprint matters, that we didn't check all those boxes all those decades for nothing. And there are three ways that we can give back. One is philanthropy. Not everybody can do that in a meaningful way that matters to them. Volunteering, we almost all engage in this. It's great. But mentorship is the only piece that's giving a piece of us. We're generating a piece of ourselves into the world. And it's living in somebody else. That's what mentorship is. It's passing something to somebody else. They accept it and they incorporate it into themselves. It's more than just a legacy. And I don't mean just a legacy, but it's more than that, because we get to feel like validated, that we are appreciated by others, that we're helpful, that we're useful, that we're productive. And many of our years are spent feeling productive, but for other people. Like, we're caring for family members, we're working at a job that's for somebody else. This is finally where we get to take what we want to give, what we want to be known for, and put that out into the world, into somebody else or many other people. So that's why it's so important to us, because it's the one thing we pick, or maybe multiple things we pick, that we're putting out to others, that, and then we get to really reap the rewards emotionally for that.
Okay, I'm glad you sort of clarified that, because at first I was wondering, is this just the next step? Because we've been caregivers, we've been doing things for, as you say, other people. So I'm really glad you pinpointed that this is something that we do for ourselves.
Yeah.
Now, I try to remember too many things sometimes, but you said something along the lines of, we can decide what we're going to give back.
Yeah.
But does it ever happen that it's just, you've got so much ingrained knowledge and wisdom about something, whatever it is, that you sort of end up there again and you're not really choosing?
Well, what happens is mentorship should be and feel organic. So most people, I don't know anybody who hasn't mentored. Let me put it that way. And nobody sets out and they say, I am going to mentor now. The term mentorship sort of got hijacked by corporate America, where it feels like it has to be something sort of work-related, and somebody's going to say, I am now going to meet with my mentor. But it's not really like that. Mentorship is something that you could be looking to your left or to your right, and that could be somebody who mentors you. They could be saying, hey, I know how to do this and you don't. Let me help you with that. How often have you done that? How often has somebody said, hey, Agnes, can you help me with this? I'm stumped here. And then you help them. That is taking a piece of what you know and adding that to that person's knowledge base. Likewise, the biggest things that we do that we mentor that doesn't, we don't even feel it, we're just doing it, is the transfer of culture, our values, our religion. These things that, religion has been passed down for centuries. That's a form of mentorship. So those traditions that you have, if you have a holiday tradition or a family tradition that's just been there for ages, that is passed down by people. They aren't saying, let me engage in mentorship now at this holiday. It's just done. So most of us are engaging in this all the time, but we're taking it for granted. We're not getting the full benefit of it. You right now, doing a podcast, it's a modern form of mentorship. You are putting a piece of yourself and your expertise out to the world. And those who are listening to it that resonate with it are saying, wow, this is meaningful to me. So we have all of these things around us that we often think, well, that's too easy, or I didn't know I was doing that, so it must not be mentorship, but it is.
So it also sounds then, generationally speaking, it can go younger, older, or sideways.
Yes, sideways has been completely overlooked. And I coined the term lateral mentoring for this because I found that when I spoke with entrepreneurs and people who are in the tech industry, those individuals don't have anybody above them. And all of us who have been doing things that, if we're the person that's starting something, you don't have somebody above to say, pull me up, please. So most of us, most of the time, are engaged in lateral mentoring, where there's no boss, there's no person who is the, you know, apprentice and the, you know, master, whatever. It is all just equal playing field, expert to expert.
I guess what I was thinking of was more just the age component.
Ah.
So we can mentor younger people. In my own case, when you said, you know, like, what do I do with for people? I still work with elders. So I still, like, you know, I'll wait for Agnes because she knows everything to know about computers, which is pure bunk, but that's what they believe. So I do spend time doing that. Or, you know, with friends that sort of say, oh, you know, you used to do that. Can you show me how to do it? So it's in terms of the ages.
I find age to be irrelevant, to be quite honest. You know, most of the time, if you're in a workplace, you'll see that it could be, there could be an age thing, but not always. You know, in some fields, people rise up in the rank at a very young age, and it doesn't matter about age. So most of us think of mentorship as someone who is older than us and wiser than us, and we are there to, you know, receive their information. But really, in the reality of things, it's everywhere. And so we really, all we have to do is look to our left and to our right, and we are looking at a mentor or a mentee at any given moment.
Yeah. Now, you also talk about something that I've often said would work so well in so many areas is bringing the generations, I'm going to go stick with age for a minute, bringing generations together to work to solve challenges, and especially in the workplace. It's like, I have a whole bunch of knowledge about this, but maybe that younger person knows something. I'll stick with tech that would make it really easy for me to do my job. So we go back and forth with that information. It's not unidirectional.
You're exactly right. And, you know, people think that I'm going to just back that up for a second. You are right. And one of the examples that I think of most often is, you know, a lot of places need to have the viewpoint of all ages. You know, if you're selling cupcakes, whatever it is, you need to know what demographic thinks about cupcakes. What each age group needs to know. You're going to need to know from everybody what they think and feel, whether it's cupcakes or it's tech or whatever it is. We need to get every age demographic's viewpoint. So in terms of mentoring, that is where we can get that happening very quickly and easily, because age sort of disintegrates when you go into expertise, because you can be an expert in anything at any age. If I'm a 21-year-old, I am a 21-year-old expert in what it thinks, how I think and feel about cupcakes. Where, you know, so when we look at consumerism, that we have to think of that. If we're thinking about expertise with regard to tech, maybe age can come into play, but it could go in any direction, really. But yes, you know, I want to also say that there is no age that is valueless with regard to mentoring. Every age is really an appropriate mentoring age and should be utilized.
Yeah, when I get on my soapbox, it's more about, you know, those people who have been with a company for 30, 40 years, they just know so much about the history up to what's happening right now. And to lose them is a huge loss for the company. So to have them bring a younger person under their wing, for lack of a better term, but then the younger person's going to bring knowledge that keeps that older person more productive, happier in the workplace, because I've talked to a number of people who have said, you know, like, there's so many employers out there that's just Like, when are you going to turn 65 so we can get rid of you? And they, what did one person say? That instead of given challenges, they're given projects. Just keep them busy until they're out of here. Whereas, as I say, it works. Like, if you can work all those different ages within the corporate structure, it's so much better for all of them and for the business.
You're 100% right. When we think about the age within workplaces, a lot of people think of age as, ooh, they're taking up a lot of our resources here. And I think of it as every time you let someone go without mentoring, you've burned down a library. You've just burned it down. It's gone. It's not coming back. So if you can utilize that individual to be able to mentor someone who's, doesn't matter about age, but newer in the organization, that's huge. The other thing is, you were exactly right, because that person who's newer in the organization and learning is going to come in with new ideas that will probably make some of the things that that person already knows new and fresh and add to it. But it'll also make it so that any kind of new building of things will not be reinventing the wheel every time. And these sorts of things are very costly if you have to reinvent the wheel. It's only a short-term gain if you say, "Hey, I'm gonna get a newer, cheaper person in here." If you don't take a year of at least getting mentorship happening, you are then costing more in the end with your company.
And I'm going to stick with the business angle right now because also that person with the history, like a younger person might come in full of ideas, and as you say, try to reinvent the wheel, whereas the older person might be able to say, a couple of years ago we tried these were the results. So just so that you don't repeat that history, maybe take it in a different direction, but this is what happened when we tried something similar in the past, so it's sort of win-win-win.
Oh,
For every level.
absolutely. And the other thing is, when a person, how often have you been somewhere and, like you mentioned, it becomes a project. You're doing something over and over and over again. It's boring. It's really rote. And when you bring some fresh perspective there, it's like when you give somebody a gift and you get to see them opening up something they've always wanted and they have that feeling of joy. That's how, and you feel so amazing when that happens. When you have somebody who has fresh eyes and a fresh experience coming in and you get to see them getting it and you get to see them coming ahead, it's that same feeling that that mentor gets in the workplace when they see their protege absorbing it and making it along. And I think that people don't realize that that mentor is the one that gets that feeling that you get just as you would giving a holiday gift to somebody that, they open it, they unwrap it, and they say, "Wow, this is just what I wanted."
How do you avoid ageism? Or I won't even say avoid it. Just make sure it doesn't raise its ugly head because you hear that too often. And it's in both directions, from older people to younger people, from younger people to older people. How do you get around that aspect?
That's really hard because we're all prejudiced against our future selves and our own selves as we age. And so this is a hardship. The way that I try to get around that is to talk to people about the fear of what we have about aging. So we think of aging as an inverted V, physical journey. You are born, you walk and talk and you run real fast and you can do things really quickly and wonderfully. And then there's a slow, steady decline. Now we all look at that and that's frightening. When I was an aging researcher, no one wanted to talk to me at a cocktail party because that is exactly what they thought about, was that slow, steady decline. What most people don't know is that at the same time, we have an emotional trajectory. And that starts at the same time at birth, and it goes up and it never declines. So I wear reading glasses. I can't run as fast as I used to, but I tell my students, "You can outrun me, but I'm happier than you." So does it matter about that? But if most people see that they have things to look forward to emotionally as they get older, that reduces some of that personal bias that people feel about themselves and about others. Because most of us, when we have children and people say, what do you want for their future? We say, we want them to be happy. We don't say, I want them to be a fast runner, you know, when they grow up. So what happens is when people start to see that there's a really amazing emotional trajectory that is filled, you know, with opportunities rather than obstacles, that's something that can reduce that. So if we're saying to somebody in the workplace, for example, you know what, we're waiting for you to hit 65 and then you're out of here. And that can be implicitly told or explicitly as we see people exit. But if people are able to applaud the things that are happening, not with an age attached to it, or people are able to see people as they are wisdom holders, as they are more senior in the workplace, that may help with that bias. Because if you see someone as a resource, you are not going to be seeing them in the same biased way. If you're looking and seeing, wow, that's like a ripe apple tree, ripe for the picking, and I can get all this information, you're not seeing them in a negative way, like, one foot out the door. It's two very different feelings. One is emotional and one is, you know, physically fear-based.
As you were talking about, you know, yourself, where somebody could, younger can run faster than you, but you're happier. Just this morning, because we've had, I guess it was expected, but a relatively unexpected snowfall, I was messaging with my brother, who's older than me, and said my grandson was concerned about you shoveling your driveway. And he said something along, and I guess I reassured him that the most Uncle Sam would have to do is just get out to the workshop and he'd be happy. And my brother responded saying something about, I try to avoid that now because it drives me crazy that it takes all day to do what I used to do in 3 hours. And my thought was, knowing my brother, is that, okay, so you're going to shovel for an hour, you're going to accomplish some of it, but you're going to have to stop. So you're going to play with the dog, you're going to mess around in the backyard with the dog, you're going to go back to shoveling, and then you're going to go in for a hot cup of coffee and your crossword puzzle, and then you'll come out and finish it. And who's had the better day other than that person who's done it in 3 hours, feet up with a cold beer in front of the TV?
Exactly.
So, it's kind of, just, I guess, the way you look at it. What makes a good mentor?
Well, you know what I'll do is I'll define for you mentor, what mentoring is, because
okay,
then it
perfect.
Comes out in that. There's never a bad mentor, because if you say, oh, there's a bad mentor, then that's not a mentor. So it's like, I like to look at it very similarly to making a friend. Everyone that crosses our path is not our friend. Does that make them a bad person? No, just maybe they're not our person, right? And it should feel like that. So you don't have to have a playbook to be a friend, where you say, you know what, I'm not going to talk behind my friend's back, and I'm not going to throw them under the bus first chance I get, and all of these things. We know we're going to listen to them and be we know what being a good friend is. So here's what a mentor is and a mentee. And it should feel the same way like going for a friend is, that you don't have to think about it. So it starts with generativity, and that's a midlife stage that we hit. Right? And that's a developmental milestone that we hit, just like walking and talking. And that's where we care for someone else without expecting anything in return. That's that same feeling that you give a gift to somebody, you watch them unwrap it, and you get just as much joy, maybe even more than they get when you see that they loved it. So this is what generativity is. So the mentor has to want to give something back. And then the mentee, there has to be a mentee that's there that's going to catch it, that says, I want that. Now, there can be a mismatch in these cases. Somebody could say, I have this information, and somebody says, I don't want that. That's not a mentoring relationship. That's just not there. Likewise, a mentee could say, hey, I'm looking for this. And the mentor says, that's not really what I'm giving out. Not mentoring. The next thing, and that doesn't make either of them bad, just as a mismatch. The next thing is it has to be intrinsically motivated. And what that means is that if I were to say to you, hey, Agnes, would you like to go volunteer your time at a soup kitchen giving out food and beverage to hungry, thirsty people? You might say, yeah, I feel really good if I did that. And if I instead said, you know, Agnes, on your way to the soup kitchen, instead go to Starbucks and give out food and beverage to hungry, thirsty people for free. that has a different feel to it. Most workplaces have the extrinsic motivator, meaning you're giving away, you're doing a little extra at work where you are expecting pay, but it doesn't get that nice feeling that you would get. That's not mentoring. So if you are being paid to be a mentor, you're not a mentor.
That was one of my questions.
that's a coach, that's an advisor, that's a guidance counselor or whatever, which does not diminish any of those, but you're not a mentor. So that it has to come from within that you want to do it without anybody even knowing about it. You know, you don't expect a certificate or anything like that. The next thing is it has to be a meaningful connection. So a lot of workplaces assign people and then they feel like, oh, I better not tell anybody I don't like my mentor because that's going to feel like a failed mentoring, you know, program, or that I'll maybe somebody will judge me that I can't get along with my mentor. So they go limping along trying to make something happen over time and it just doesn't work. So there has to be a meaningful connection. You have to like the person. You have to actually care about that person. Another thing is trust. And this is a huge one in the workplace. So if you are a mentee and you're looking for a mentor and you feel like the person that is above you might say, you know what? I didn't know that this person doesn't know this. I don't know that I want to give them a raise or a good performance eval. That could make you say, I don't trust somebody because I'm afraid they would think less of me. Likewise, if you're a mentor in the mentoring position and you say, you know what? I'm afraid that person's going to steal my idea or my clients. I don't trust that they're not going to do that. And that happens in finance. There are certain, you know, areas of work where that can happen. And finally, a person has to have a goal. It can be a one-time goal. Hey, show me the lay of the land in this new workplace. Or it could be something that changes over time. You know, that as you meet a goal, it changes and grows with you over time. So a good mentor is really a mentor. There's no good or bad. If there's something bad, like people will say a toxic mentor, that's not a mentor. A mentor is not, it has to meet all of those things. It means if when I hear the term toxic mentor, it means there's not a meaningful connection. They probably don't trust the person. And there's some other motivator other than, you know, an intrinsic motivation that's happening. So they're missing some of those components. So it would be the same as if you said, yeah, I have this friend who every day, you know, throws me under the bus, talks behind my back and does all these terrible things. That's really not a friend. So we should look at it in a similar way.
What about if we take the tor and the t off and we'll discuss the mint? What I'm thinking of is, I'm going to stick with the age thing for now. Younger person comes in and looks at some subject that the older person is part of their DNA practically. The younger person isn't particularly interested or like the subject, but they know in the long run it will get them ahead. So they go to the older person and they're honest, they're upfront. You've got this knowledge. Can you share it with me? But both of them know that this younger person, the mentee, is not that keen on whatever the mint is.
Then that would be a sponsor, or that could be something else in that place, but it's not a mentor. You know, a sponsor is somebody who opens doors for others or gets them places. It can be an advisor. You don't have to have a meaningful connection with somebody as an advisor. That term mentor gets placed on a lot of things that are really something else that then makes it feel like mentoring fails all the time. When mentoring is it's an actual emotional life stage. It's an emotional thing. It is not a transactional thing. So when I say generativity, it often gets mistaken for things like generosity. And generosity is you go to the ice cream shop and they give you an extra scoop of ice cream. As soon as you eat it, it's gone. That's what that person is maybe asking for somebody. Can you generously give me some of your information so I can go do something with it? I'm going to ingest it and run away with it. You know, it could be that a person is thinking of a tit for a tat, you know, reciprocity. That's also not mentoring. So it's really, you know, it has to all be there. And you could call it an advisor, but most places don't, or a coach or something else, or a sponsor. But that's probably what that person is looking for. Like, hey, I need a sponsor, somebody to open a door for me.
Wow. It's really interesting that so many things that would, for the, what's the neophyte, pass as mentoring. It's like, okay, no, actually, you know, if you're being paid for it, if, you know, somebody's not into it, whatever, if there's a little bit of animosity, something, it's not mentoring. So a whole new vocabulary out there by the sounds of it.
You know, I write about that in the book because there are so many instances when people feel intimidated about engaging in mentorship because they feel like they're going to get rejected by somebody, or they feel like, I don't have the right expertise. And people will think you have to be a professional with a degree, you know, in order to mentor. And in the workplace, there are plenty of people who can be mentoring and they don't have a degree. They're not a professional. And I mean, everywhere, mentoring is everywhere. It is not just for someone who's a lawyer or a doctor or, you know, an MBA of some sort. It's really for everybody.
I'm glad you sort of brought that out, because another place I wanted to go during our discussion was that most of the women I know are quick to name their children and or their grands as their biggest accomplishment, shall we say. Obviously, I say obviously, maybe it isn't, but mentoring is like intergenerationally within the family unit, for example, or a friend area, is in my head, although you've changed a few of my ideas so far, is that that's mentoring. Like, as you bring someone up to, and they want to learn how to be a good person, or to, you know, do this or do that, or anything from knitting to cooking to, you know, fixing up the computer, whatever the knowledge that goes back and forth is mentoring. But is it mentoring when it's just, oh, and there's that word, I hate that word, when it's like within the family unit or within the friend circle?
Yeah, you know, I don't count it generally for parents at all. You're expected to be teaching and guiding your children, right? But grandparents, no, that's a whole different thing. And our most powerful mentors in the world are generally grandparents in many cases. Because how does the religion get passed down through the family? How does the traditions, how do the values, that gets passed down oftentimes by the grandparents that then pass that on down. So I'll give you an example of how this looks. When I was a kid, I was 5. I was the oldest grandchild in the family. And my grandfather would take me in his big giant car driving around Des Moines, Iowa, to do the errands every Saturday. Now, he was helping my mom by giving her a break and taking me around. But as he drove, he would talk about all the people that we passed. And he'd say, hey, you see Mary over there? She's had a tough life, you know, but she put her 2 kids through college and, you know, she's a hard worker. You know, see Jim over there? His wife just chewed him out for not bringing in the dry cleaning. Now, as a 5-year-old, I was assuming he knew everybody. But what he was doing, and he would tell me every single week after, you know, driving around for hours, doing all the errands, you never know, based on what a person looks like, what kind of life they had. They all have complex stories inside. Well, I became a psychologist. I thought after that, well, of course you look at a person and you try to imagine what they are more than just what they're presenting at the moment. There's something, some inner workings happening. That's powerful mentorship. And so he passed that on to me. And grandparents have the ability to do that because they're one step away. You know, they're not worried about making sure that the child is minding what they're supposed to be doing and all of the extra stuff that goes into being a parent. They get to do what they're going to do and then pass them back to the parents. But in that time, a lot of magic happens. So that's just one example. But every grandparent out there is definitely mentoring in many different ways.
I had another question. You've widened my mind in so many ways that I hope I'm not repeating myself. First of all, is there a difference between mentoring and volunteering?
Yeah, So mentoring is coming from you. I can go be a docent at the zoo. And I'm volunteering my time. I can go and be at a soup kitchen, you know, giving my time and my energy and whatever. When I'm mentoring, I am giving a piece of me. Right now, you, Agnes, are giving a piece of you in this podcast. You are saying, I am, every time I do a podcast, giving a little piece of me out into the world. That's a form of mentorship. There's a difference there when you're doing that. One is coming from you, and the other one is originating from somebody else's, you know, idea or somebody else's already created, you know, whatever it is that's there. So that's the one key difference. If you go to philanthropy, that's like 1 degree away from meeting with people, right? You know, you're giving money. Volunteering, you're working with people. Mentoring, you're giving of yourself. That's really, if you were to look at them in a row, that's how they all are. But all three of those are generativity, and we generally do all three of them. You might round up at the grocery store. You might give a dollar here and there. That's philanthropy. You might volunteer somewhere, and you're also mentoring. We tend to like to do them all.
Okay. Where I was going to go, but I wanted to clarify that first, was just, you know, you sort of, and I mean this in the most polite way, positive, you nix the parent-child alleged mentoring, non-mentoring. But I was wondering if I take my grandson to go do some volunteer work or something like that, is that mentoring him? So I'm mentoring him, although I'm not mentoring the people at the soup kitchen.
Correct. So here's what you're mentoring. You're mentoring values to your grandson. So you are mentoring, this is what we do. This is how we are connected to the community. This is how we are, you know, we are viewing that we like to be good contributors to the world. That is you mentoring him, and he's a mentee, and he's also a volunteer, and you're also a volunteer, all at the same time.
Okay. I love the conversations where I come out so much clearer than I think I go in clear, but I'm obviously not. You also talk about nonprofits, seeing as how we just mentioned the other words. Where does that fit into the equation? Because you said philanthropy. Well, okay, once again, I'm probably making connections that don't exist. Tell us about nonprofits.
Well, you know, a lot of places, you know, like I run a nonprofit. It's called the Mentor Project, right? And so that organization is built to get people to mentor. Most nonprofits are looking to engage in a community or for some kind of a value. And that allows people to get out and to do community things that make them feel good. There's usually a passion behind it, whether that's like to raise money for cancer, or whether it's, you know, cancer research, or whether it's to get people mentoring, whatever that may be. Those nonprofits are run to make those things possible for people to engage in. Now, does that mean that everybody there is mentoring and volunteering and engaged in philanthropy? No, they're companies. They work as companies just like any other job does. In terms of the Mentor Project, however, everyone who works, not works, who is involved in it is a mentor. They're not paid, and they give their time for free with their expertise. We don't tell them what they should mentor in. They say, here's what I'd like to mentor in, and then we wait to see if a mentee comes along and says, I want to match that. That is how we work. But if you go to work, you know, if you decided to engage with like the March of Dimes or Girl Scouts or any other kind of an organization, you're an employee like you would be anywhere else.
Can you tell us about the Mentor's Edge? Is that what it? No, the Mentorship Project. Sorry, I got to get you, because once your project. what sort of expertises do people come with waiting to find a potential mentee?
You know, that has changed over time, because it started, we did not anticipate starting an organization. What happened was, when I was starting to talk to people about mentorship, I found out so many top 1% leaders in whatever field they were in were saying, I don't have access to mentees. I'm kind of living in a silo. And so, for example, the first person that we started with, his name is Bill Cheswick. He's one of the fathers of the firewall. Like, we are communicating because of him and his work when he was at Bell Labs. And so he said, I'm getting ready to retire and I'm going to be living on a farm. I have no one that I can't go to a park and say, hey, kid, you want a mentor? You know, this was something that was a big deal to him. And it sounds trivial to a lot of people, but imagine the feeling that you're irrelevant, that you're useless, that you don't have anything to offer, that all of that work, you know, he's like got stuff in museums. Imagine feeling like there's nobody that's ever going to see anything of yours again. That's frightening. So I found there were a lot of other people feeling the same way. But we started just with Bill, and he wanted to give back STEM, you know, like science and math to kids. And he particularly wanted young kids before they got jaded and said, oh, I can't do math and science. So we started to bring him out into schools. And, you know, we thought, okay, this is it. It's just going to be like 10 of us, and we're just doing this for fun. We were volunteering. We started the company with $547 and thought, okay, good, this covers all of our costs. We're okay. And then we went from 10 to 60 within 6 months, and then to 80, then to 100 within a year of mentors saying, I want to mentor. We did not know there were so many people who had the need and desire, this developmental need and desire not being met. They didn't have, like Bill, people around that they could appropriately say, hey, I'd like to mentor. And so when we started the mentor project, we started with mostly STEM, and then we had an artist come on. So we added an A and made it STEAM. And then we had lawyers and finance and business and law, you know, all of these things that came on, people that came on board. And so we really grew to cover all of those bases. And in last year in 2024, we gave out $3 million of mentoring hours. And in the 5 years, we have been in 7 countries. And so our mentors have, you know, really done global work with giving back in the way that they wanted to.
So the question that comes to mind, and I'm on the west coast of Canada, so we just have this whole union headspace, is Bill, for example, when he goes into the school, does he actually teach the subjects, or does he create and just get that enthusiasm to learn, or some of the techniques for learning, or something like that? What would he like? I'm picking on Bill right at the moment, but
That's a good
what would he
idea.
do?
He's a good one to pick on. So yeah, what we did in the beginning was we said, you know what, let's find out who would like a mentor and a mentor like Bill. So most people, like when I was young, I didn't know I wanted to be a psychologist. I didn't even know that that existed until I found out that there was one and they can fix grandmas, right? You know, so there's that. Now we thought, well, if people see that the work Bill does is so cool, you know, kids, that might inspire them to want more. So he would go in and give a talk about something that was really cool that he did. And he has so many super cool things that he does. And he went in and he would do that, and the kids would become fascinated. So then one school said, listen, can you come every Wednesday? We'll call it Ches Day. And then he would go in and he'd bring a new topic and talk with the kids about it. And then those who wanted more could do one-on-one. And those who didn't were not being mentored necessarily. They were being inspired or whatever, but the mentorship was there for those who wanted it. What we did find is sometimes those one-offs were really powerful for students because it got them really excited to go then go do something on their own. So the big idea was to bring somebody in to give an idea, you know, a panel discussion or a discussion all on their own to show a topic area, and then we see who then reaches out for one-on-one, or where do they go from there?
I love the STEM concept because oftentimes a teacher can be really good, like have really good knowledge, but they're not good at teaching it. So could the mentor in that case create the enthusiasm, the excitement, and if asked a specific question, perhaps give a tip for learning it or something to make the learning of it easier for that individual? I'm not trying to come down on teachers, but I'm
No,
just.
you're right. So what they don't do is they don't do lesson plan. They don't go in and say, "Oh, you're doing earth science. I will cover that topic for you." What they do, though, is they will say, "Here, I'm going to talk to you about quantum mechanics. Here we go. We'll talk about this and, talk about some high-level thing that people would say no kid that age could do that, but let's go ahead and talk about it." Or rocketry or whatever. Now, what happens is usually there is some teaching involved. Here's what happens. Here's how rocketry works. Here's how the blast off happens. And so there will be some teaching involved with regard to that. Now, it's usually different than learning from a book, so it's more fun and those tips work. And then that helps for when they go to learn it in the classroom. So it's not a replacement for learning, but they might get a new idea or a new grasp of something based on that.
I had one of those math teachers.
Oh.
super smart, but it was just like after getting straight A's, it was just like I glazed over with this
I
one
think we've
person.
all had that kind of math teacher at one point or another.
Talk to us about going into developing countries.
Well, there's one really cool story. We've been in several. One, during COVID, we had a teacher reach out to us from Argentina, and he said, "I would love to do hackathons with kids from different countries." And so we did some of those with kids from Argentina, the US, and then Russia came in. All.
What are hackathons?
Oh, a hackathon is where you have a weekend. It could be any period of time. And you, sorry about that. I should have
No,
said
that's
that up
okay.
front. It's where you say, "I'd like you to solve a problem," and you work on a team. And your team of four or five students would work to solve a problem. And each one has a problem to solve. It could be the same or it could be different ones. And then you, at the end, compete to see who, how they do on it. And each team would have mentors so that could help them. And it was amazing to see kids that didn't speak the same native language working together and, how they would come about with answers and things. It was fabulous. That was one. But the cool, one of the really neat things was we got a call from someone who ran a school in Shiradi, Tanzania. It's a very small village, and they had a school of 500 students, and they had not had Western art like cartooning. And so we happened to have a cartoonist, the senior artist for Schultz Creative Studios, who's out on the west coast of the United States in California. And he's the guy that draws Snoopy and all of that. And he said, "I'd love to go and, show them what this is like." So he went for, I don't know, 10 days. And he did a giant mural, and the whole community came out for it. And the students were learning the art from him and really getting excited about it and learning how to infuse emotion into cartoons and really amazing stuff. So it was so great that he continued it on Zoom. He would have to get up at 4 in the morning, and all the kids had to crowd around one computer in order to do this. So that was a year-long thing. Then he went back and got to go again, and he then was able to show the teachers how to do all of this. And then this past year, he just in January, he went to Brooklyn, New York, to do the same stuff he was doing in Tanzania with kids in Brooklyn. And so it's really interesting to see how kids, it doesn't matter where they are, developing country or not in a developing country, they're all operating the same. You know, they all, you know, Justin, the artist, called me from, you know, texted me from Sherrod. He was like, I don't know if the kids like me. They're not saying anything. And he did the same from Brooklyn on the first day. I don't know if they like me. They're not doing anything. They're middle schoolers. By the end, you know, there was all of this magnetism and wonderful stuff happening and kids that were doing art that they had never done before. So that was kind of a cool thing to learn, that kids are kids wherever they are. And, you know, everybody likes to learn and, you know, is kind of the same. The playing field is the same.
You're going to hate me, but I'm going to throw yet another scenario into that. Just figuring out about mentorship. If, for example, the cartoonist worked for a company who was really big on, whether it's the community or world or whatever, just getting people, moving people ahead. So they said, we've heard that there's this demand for a cartoonist to go and mentor these kids down in Tanzania. We want you to go because you've done it before in Brooklyn. Like, I'm just changing your story here. And we're going to pay you for 2 months to go down and do that. Is that another wrench into the works, or is that person still a mentor?
I would say no. They're getting paid. So Justin took his own vacation time from work and was not paid. Now, most people say, that's crazy, I would not do that. But he does that. All of our mentors are not paid, sure, and they don't get money. So if you are doing that, that's your job. Just like a teacher, that's your job. If you're doing that, you're a good teacher. Now, I will throw a wrench into this myself and say, here's another layer to this. Can you mentor and be a teacher? Yes. And I give an example of a few examples of this, you know, college professors and teachers in the book, because when you are teaching, oftentimes teachers will meet with their students outside of school on their own time. And that's when the mentorship happens. So in the case of in the Mentorship Edge, I write about a teacher who was an elementary school teacher. And there was one student who was really had a terrible home life. And she would follow this teacher home after school. And the teacher would say, you know, this was during the 70s, times were different. She would actually work with this student in terms of mentoring her. And how do you relate in the world? How do you trust people? How do you make sure that, you know, you can have a nice relationship and know that nice relationships exist? You know, all kinds of things that allowed this person to thrive and say, wow, I matter. Well, this was mentoring. She was doing this. She didn't know this teacher. She didn't realize that. She just cared about her students. Turns out when she retired, she made a posting on Facebook, and that student reached out to her and she said, I want to tell you what you did for me. My home life was so terrible. I was the first person to graduate high school. Then I went on to graduate college. And now my daughter is graduating from college. And it was because you taught me that I could, you know, it was more values, it was more emotion that she was transferring to her, that she mattered and that she got to see different values than she was getting at home. And so we have mentorship that can happen in workplaces, but we just have to distinguish between where are you getting paid and where are you not getting paid.
Right, right. Now, I opened by saying that, you know, a lot of women I know would say, I don't really have any skills. I mean, they've just been working and raising a family and doing all sorts of community work for decades. But they still say, oh, I've not done anything. But they still want to give back. Is there any way to convince them or help them find that, A, they could mentor and find what they could mentor in at?
Absolutely. Oh, like shame, shame, shame. No one should say they can't mentor. everyone can. Look, I'm going to tell you how my grandmother mentored me in one way that no one knew about. Every holiday, I get out my grandmother's cards, index cards with all of her handwritten recipes on it that were passed down from her mother. And I make these. No one thinks anything about it. We eat the same meal at every holiday. Like every holiday has its set meal. If I leave anything out, though, it feels like it's not the holiday. You could step into the room and it smells like that holiday. It tastes like that holiday and it has that holiday feel. Well, I didn't understand the depth of this until my uncle came to visit. Now, his wife was making all of her family's foods. But he came to stay with us and he was so floored and taken aback because this hit him like a truck. That my family traditions, was what he said, are here. I feel so at home now. And it brings us back. That's what carries us. So anyone can do that. If you can write a recipe on a card, you can mentor, right? That is mentoring a value that gets passed or a tradition that gets passed forward. Another thing that people don't realize that is mentoring is anytime that you get involved in things like in your community, where if there's a faith-based organization that you belong to, like any kind of a church or a mosque or a synagogue or whatever it is that you belong to, that's an opportunity to mentor those who share the same values as you. So that continues on. Religion has been passed down for centuries. Who's doing that? That's not, you know, we don't listen. We don't revere the accountant from, you know, centuries ago. You know, we really are revering the emotional things that matter to us. And most people have put a value on work-based mentorship when really that's not what's going to be remembered later. It's going to be the emotional values that matter to us. And everyone holds that. And that is what most families say. I want my values passed on. Or I would like to make sure that more people in the community hold my values. That is where you can get engaged in that. And that can be any kind of civic engagement. That can be in any kind of, like you're doing with a podcast. It can be writing a blog. It can be doing some of the more modern things that we have access to now that gets our wisdom out to others.
Perfect word, because I wanted to ask, on your website, and in my intro, I quoted, wisdom meets innovation. Can you explain that, please?
You're doing it right now. Look at you imparting wisdom on a podcast. So we all have ways of innovating to get our wisdom out. We all have new ways of doing this. We now have Zoom. We're in a tech boom right now where we all can communicate. You're on a different side of the continent than I am. Here we are communicating. I'm learning from you. You're learning from me. We're having an exchange of wisdom here. And that is something that is really, we're right in this really ripe time to harness innovation to help us to impart our wisdom. If we didn't have any kind of a Riverside or Zoom or any of that, I would not know what you're doing. I wouldn't be able to know anything about what you have to say or what your wisdom is. And nowadays, we can communicate with anyone around the world. And most podcasts are global. Most blogs are global. Most ways that we can get our word out, all of social media is global. You know, we have ways in which we can get that out there in fabulous ways. Our wisdom can be put everywhere.
I'm not looking for compliments here. In the case of my podcast, my guest is imparting knowledge to our listeners. I feel that I'm only the vehicle, shall we say?
Well, listen, who had the idea? Who asks the questions? It's you, right? Am I here as one person helping on today? Yes. But you have an entire platform. So if I am looking for wisdom about boomers, I'm going to tune in over and over again because I want more, right? That's you. That's not me. I'm one little nugget in your big sea of podcasting. And so am I a part of it? Yeah, but it's you. You're driving the bus.
I love my bus.
I'm sure a lot of people do also. So So you should toot your horn.
Sound like a train now. Okay. What haven't I asked you that you want mid-age women out there to think about in terms of becoming a mentor?
I was going to say,
or maybe being a mentee.
Yeah, I will say that's a good thing to say, because what everyone should do is look to their left and look to their right. One of those is a mentor. One of those is a mentee. You're a mentor. You're a mentee. Think of every single person that you meet as a potential mentor or mentee, and that you have the power to impart whatever it is that's most meaningful to you to somebody else. And it's kind of your job. You should be doing that.
Is there a fine line between mentoring? I'm just thinking, as you were talking about passing on, you know, whether it's tradition or beliefs or whatever, is there a fine line between mentoring and lecturing?
Yes, because there's no fine line. They're not connected. So if I'm lecturing, is there a meaningful connection? No. Are the two of us, is there any way in which we're connected? No, there really isn't. Is there a goal with that? Where's the mentee? Is that person looking for that information? So no, in that case, that's not mentorship. We need that connection. In the case of, you know, you are not lecturing on a podcast, you're imparting information. Those people who come back and say, I want to listen to that, that's meaningful to them. It's a weaker form, you know, with the two that both know each other and feel mutually connected, but it's still that form. But if I'm just lecturing into the wind, no, it's not mentoring.
You have clarified so many gray areas. I don't think I've ever come into a podcast with so many misconceptions and gray areas, so I appreciate that. Is this the kind of stuff we can expect in your book? Tell us about your book.
Yeah, you know, I wrote the book because I really was so tired of having mentorship being hijacked and talked about in ways that it really, you know, isn't looked at as a developmental thing we should be expecting to do. So if you check out the book, you'll see that I really do define mentorship and say what it is and what it isn't. And I define what the other things are: networking, coaching, all of the other things that we should be going for also, but are different, and how you can use those together to mentor. But I also give real life examples, from grandmas to artists to military to corporate examples, writers, an astronaut. He got saved in space by a lateral mentor and made it back home safely. I give examples of all of these so that everyone can see where they can fit into mentorship and where they can bring it into their life. And I talk about hierarchical and lateral, so that people can see that mentoring is really all around us. So it's not a hard read. It's an easy read in the sense that you don't have to like read a lot of high level psychological concepts or things. It's made for real life because we're all living real life.
Where did you find your stories, the anecdotes about people?
When I was really interested in finding out if what the truth was with mentorship, and are we really built to do it like it says in the theories and like research indicates, I started to talk to people, and people were telling me their stories. But a lot of the mentors are from the Mentor Project. So we have astronaut Charlie Camarda, who told me the story of what happened to him in space. And if I have a second, I'll tell it to you, because
please do.
Oh my gosh, it was unbelievable. So imagine it's 2003, and you are one of the people watching the Columbia space shuttle come back to Earth. As it re-entered Earth's atmosphere, it disintegrated, to the horror of everyone watching.
This is sounding familiar.
So they sent another mission up in 2005 to follow it. The astronauts get up there. They're excited. They're like, yay. This is better than I ever expected. So imagine yourself, you're in space and it's better than you ever expected. And you get a call from Mission Control and they say, hey, that problem you had that they had before you, you might have the same one. Now, if you can imagine, you're up in space, you can't open the door and say, I'm out of here. So Charlie Camarda was that guy that got that call in space and had to say to himself, do I call? He was a single parent taking care of his daughter. Do I have to call my daughter, who's just a little kid, and tell her I'm not coming home? Or is there a way I can make it home? So what he did was he brought with him a little black book. This is pre, like, cell phone days, you know, whatever, where you have, like, the contacts in there. He brought a book with him, and he called the person that he trusted most in the world to help him with this. He didn't trust his boss, because his boss was the one that called and said, we don't know if you're going to make it home or not. So he called the most trusted person, and he said, can you help me learn what I need to know so that I can see if we can make it through? They worked out everything that his friend knew and he knew. And the guy said, you're going to have to do a spacewalk to fix the tiny little tile that was the thing that made it so that the other mission didn't make it home safely. So Charlie called Mission Control and he said, we have to do a spacewalk. They sent somebody out and they made it home safely. Now, that guy that he called was a lateral mentor. How often have you called somebody in a pinch, somebody you needed desperately to help you with something, and that person helped you? We do that all the time. That's lateral mentoring. That was somebody he trusted. It was a meaningful connection. He was motivated. No one paid him. Nobody knows that guy's name. So Charlie wrote a book about this. But this story is in the book because most of us don't think of the power of mentorship, how it can save our life in a time of crisis. But that who wouldn't step up? If your friend called you and said, I need you, you're going to say, yeah, I'll help you. And likewise, vice versa. So these are the things that we don't really think twice about and we're doing every single day. So I have a lot of examples that are like this, that are from, you know, the tech boom, people that started the tech boom, to grandmas, grandpas, to all sorts of other people. And they were all from the Mentor Project or other people that I had interviewed a few years ago or over time to talk about their different experiences with mentorship to highlight how actually ordinary it all is.
Sounds like a great read. Like, forget the mentoring, just the stories, I'm sure, are either heartwarming or exciting or whatever. Yeah, that's amazing. One last question. Are you fixing grandmas?
I think I'm fixing grandmas because I'm getting people to mentor. And when people feel valued, when they feel relevant, when they feel seen, validated, they're emotionally happier and they live physically longer lives. So I think so, just in a different way.
Yeah, sounds excellent. Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
You can find me at deborahheiser.com. I write for Psychology Today, so you can find my blog, The Right Side of 40, there. And you can find me at mentorproject.org. And you can find the book anywhere you buy books.
Okay. So there's something on your website that made me wonder if it was actually out there, but it is.
It's out there. Yep. It's been around. And you can, if you're somebody who likes to listen, like a podcaster would, it's on audiobook too.
Okay. And you're on social?
I am. You can find me on LinkedIn. You know, I have a YouTube account, but I don't really do much with it. I'm mostly on LinkedIn.
Okay, that's great. Okay, so your website link
is
one or two? No, I was just going to say, I'll get it.
Okay.
It's in the show notes. I'm going to put all the links on your page at our website. Listeners, what are your thoughts on mentoring? I've said often that we are the wise women now. We have experience and time on our side. Who could you mentor? Leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. Maybe there was a question. Oh, I asked all sorts of gray area questions of Deborah. But if I missed something, ask it in the comments and I'll get you an answer. Share this episode. I know you're out there wondering what you can do with these years of wisdom and time and energy. So are your friends. Think of the impact you could have together. If you're not ready yet, perhaps you have a friend who has a lot to offer with Deborah's encouragement. Share this episode with her. If you enjoyed this conversation, click the follow button wherever you're listening. It does help us grow. I'm also registered at Substack. Following there is free, and you'll get notified every time an episode is released. Deborah Heiser, thank you for being my guest today. And you gave us so much food for thought, but you clarified so many things that I don't, they were gray areas in my head. I don't know if our listeners were in the same boat, but also encouraging us to continue to make an impact as we help others grow.
It was a delight to be on your show. Thank you for having me. And I'm really excited that you're out there making a difference. So thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you again. Have a great rest of week.
You too.